Hi, I'm John Paris, and I'm here in Quadros' Corner.
So you literally had Willy Wonka as a father.
He had the Willy Wonka of Bubblegum. The movie is Andy Paris, Bubblegum King. It's about my father in the late 1940s. World War II hit, and there was heavy rationing of sugar and latex mm-hmm. being the key ingredient. The business, the bubblegum business, lasted for 8 years. It was a short reign for the king, okay, because he was in an all-cash business. He had a pistolero that would ride in the back of his Cadillac convertible when they haul ass down into Monterey, and he'd have sometimes $250,000 in a suitcase to pay his factory workers and to pay for the latex. Basically, the film has worldwide distribution. McAllen was known as a farming community, but my dad descended down here. He did this crazy big thing, and I mean, it was just explosive.
I don't know, like when someone says I got a lot of crazy stuff.
Well, I feel like well, let's say I'll
let you start with the craziest, okay?
Okay, sure. Well, let's start with that. After I'd been, I was born and raised in McAllen, and when school was out, mm-hmm. I stayed behind for about a year working for my dad. He had a vending business that was all over the valley, and he kind of controlled the valley as far as vending businesses goes. But once I was up in Austin and was established, had some friends, I can think of a crazy time. I was in this band called Oboyo. And I mean, they actually named the band Oboyo after this. There was like a portable toilet company that was all over Austin. You would see Oboyo and everything. And I guess the lead singer wanted to call it that for, for some reason.
Oboyo. How do you spell that?
O-B-O-Y-O. Oboyo.
Oboyo.
Right. And so we had this gig, and it was down off of Riverside at a place that's long gone now. Once we got to the gig, we realized our lead singer had been arrested for unpaid warrants for riding a scooter without a license. And so what we had to do is we had to improvise. We had to improvise on stage and play a lot of the songs instrumentally, without his vocals. And we also mentioned that we don't have a vocalist tonight. He's been arrested and we're raising money to bail him out. So people came in droves, and they were putting all this money into our tip jar and whatever. And we got him out of jail. Okay.
So
we got him out, and he said, hey, you know, there was a party over at this co-op. And this was a time in Austin where this is just around the slacker area.
Oh, I've seen that movie. So we were just talking about how John moved to Austin, and he was in a band called Boyo.
Yeah, Oboyo.
Oh, Oboyo. Huh? And then someone got arrested.
Yeah, so We had a gig, and we were going to play it. I forget the name of the club because this is years ago, and it's been defunct forever, but it was off of Riverside. It was kind of in that sort of triangular area there in Austin, by Riverside and South First Street. And we got up on stage, and we just started playing without the vocalist and just doing instrumental stuff. And then we announced that, hey, our vocalist got arrested for, unpaid warrants. He was riding a scooter that he didn't have a license for. And so we're taking up a collection to try to bail him out. So it was amazing. There was a lot of people in the audience who just came up and put money in this tip jar, and we were able to get enough to go and bail him out. So we got him out of jail, and it was late. It was past midnight. And he was saying, like, hey, man, we should go over to this keg party. I know there's a keg party over at this co-op. And so we went into West Campus, which is and this is during the slacker time there.
Wait, can I stop you before you go there? Uh-huh. When you ask for donations to bail him out of jail, mm-hmm. and people started donating, mm-hmm. were you surprised that they were? Because is it common for for that to happen, where people were like,
at that time, I would say, you know, this is still when this is when Austin was not really huge like it is now, like the monster it is now. We're talking, this was, we're going back to, this is 1986, okay?
Because what I would have done if I was if I was you in your situation, yeah. I would have been like, we should just tell every night that our band member is in jail. And we'll get lots of tips.
Oh, God. But, you know, what's funny is that once we got him out, he wanted to go to that, that party. Yeah. And when we got there, the party was long gone, but there was a bunch of beer left. So what we did was in these co-ops that where these, a lot of the students will live, you know, they've got all a kind of a commissary, and they've got all their goods, you know, in huge bulk. And we found this gigantic plastic mayonnaise jar, and we filled that sucker full of beer.
Oh, really?
We walked down the street, and we sat in the middle of that street, passing this thing and drinking this beer. We brought a couple of them and drank for over an hour or two until we were really just stoned, wasted. We walked to my apartment, rest of the band.
Is the apartment like the same as a co-op?
Nope, my apartment, but it was very close by to the co-op. This little neighborhood, West Campus, it's just intricate little bits and pieces of apartments, houses, co-ops. And, you know, my apartment was only two blocks away from where we'd been hanging out. And we just walked there, and we all passed out. In my bedroom. This is 1986. Everyone passed out in my bedroom, half on the bed, half on the floor. And seems like
around that time, 1986, yeah. Was was it common for Austin to still have that? Austin is weird. Or when did
absolutely
when did that start? Yes. How did that start? Do you know?
Well, the Keep Austin Weird thing was really, I think it was put into play basically when people were starting to get afraid that it was getting too big. And I would say that was put into play in the early 2000s, the Keep Austin Weird. Mm. Austin had already been kind of just a really incredibly original place for, mm-hmm. you know, many years.
Yeah.
Many years.
So it was all to like not for people to be like not interested in moving to Austin to scare them away in a way.
I would say it was to not over commercialize it. Like in other words, Keep Austin Weird was like, let's keep this place unique. Mm. It was because people started seeing properties getting bought out. Even then, at that time, in the early 2000s, they were starting to get afraid that that its popularity, you know, was going to grow into something else. And, I mean, basically, we know what it is now. Is it's a gigantic city. It's a monster of a city. And it's untenable if you're not a really rich trustafarian or a rich electronics person. I mean, it's wild.
Do you feel like the Valley could be like the new Austin?
Well, I'm concerned. I'm concerned about the Valley. I think that the Valley right now is starting to remind me of like kind of like the old Austin, because there is a lot of art going on here.
I mean, it's right behind your back.
It's just, I know, it's just incredible. It's moving back down here is really... exceeded my expectations, okay? I've met a lot of really cool people. There's a lot of people that are great appreciators of art. But as far as this place being the new Austin, I'd like it to be the new Austin of when Austin was a cool place, you know? I'm a little concerned of the behaviors I see going on in the city of McAllen. It seems like they're trying to run the Austin playbook, and I'm a little concerned. I would say, I guess maybe 3-4 weeks ago, I mm-hmm. drove into McAllen, and all of a sudden they had painted all these bike lanes. Mm. And I mean, was just like there was smoke coming out of my ears. I was so mad to see that.
Why is that a concern for you?
They took away parking spaces. And I talked to a couple of people at the Phoenix on the last party at the Phoenix that happened. Mm-hmm. It was that actual
duality,
day that they did it.
Duality.
Right. On that day, they had gone and painted them. I was talking to Sandra about that. And she said, like, yeah, they're trying to keep people from parking around here. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's a very commercial area. Half of it is commercial. Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like most of it is commercial nowadays.
Yeah.
But it's like integrated with residential. So it's a mm-hmm. quite like an interesting mix for those that might be listening or watching that are like, well, where is this at? So it's by Main yeah. and Old 83. Because I used to yep. live there on that street.
Yeah, they call it Old Town now. Or it's the Arts District, and then they're also calling it Old Town.
Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because that was like the first road, one of the first roads?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't know I'm speculating on that, but recently I was asking.
Because it's called Main Street.
Yeah, sure, it's Main Street, but the little neighborhood between Hackberry and Pecan, they call it Old Town.
Mm. Why do you think that is?
I mean, that this is the original, you know, very old part of McAllen.
Yeah. There's nice houses there.
There are. I love that area. And then it's also the Arts District. And I noticed there on Hackberry, there's a building that says Arts District Business. Yeah.
Like the houses there are like you could film a movie there.
Absolutely.
Like in most. And the interesting part is that all the houses, they're mm-hmm. not the same. Like everyone has their mm-hmm. their style, their different architecture. But you were yes. saying that the bike lanes, why is that causing a disturbance?
It's taking away parking opportunities. And I was like, oh gosh, I've seen this movie before. I just escaped from that. You know, I escaped from stuff like that. I was having a discussion.
But I think you could still park regardless if there's bike lanes. I think it's in the thing that
can happen. You? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I lived on that street.
Okay.
The only difference now is that it's much more narrow
yeah.
to drive.
Right.
But before you could use the whole space.
Right.
Now the only difference is because of the bike lanes.
Yeah.
You can't be driving all the way on
right.
the far right or on the, you know, so.
It doesn't look like, I don't see a lot of cyclists though. In
yeah. I think
that's,
they're trying
that's
to,
the thing.
They're trying
this
to
is
promote,
why.
Yeah. I think it's brand new. So they're yeah. trying to promote the, because
yeah.
everything's right there. Like if you live right. in that area, mm-hmm. you literally have HEB, you yeah. have the expressway, the, yeah. the airport, the hotel.
Right.
You have all the bars.
Yep.
So the grocery stores, mm-hmm. Ruben's Grocery. I don't know
yeah.
if you've been.
I haven't been yet, but I've seen a million posts about it. It's definitely on the list
yeah,
to check
everything
it out.
There is like so close to. Mm-hmm. To everything,
yeah,
it's all meshed together, and mm-hmm. I think maybe the bike lane is perhaps to promote more of like people to use their bikes because
yeah, I just
well, everybody
I,
uses their cars now.
I gotcha. It just the other thing I was concerned about was the public being not wanting the. Green Jay Park being used. And
which park is that one?
That's the one south of town that was by the old golf course, Green Jay Park. It was it's also a disc park.
Yeah.
Okay. There was a lot in the news in the past few months about that. I have a friend who went and spoke to at town hall about that, saying like, hey, you know, if Zoho is going to come into town, why does it have to be here in mm-hmm. a park that people want to use?
What is Soho?
Yeah. They're an Indian company, high-tech company, and they've got some offices in Austin, and now they've got some in McAllen.
What do they sell?
Um, I I'm not entirely sure what they sell. I know that they're, I think they're a business-to-business software company from what I understand.
Software?
Yes. They're not a hardware company.
Got it. So they're coming to McAllen. They're trying
yeah.
to
come. And the you know, McAllen was saying, like, well, we've had all these, we've lost so many people, and we lose them so every year to, you know, moving away to Austin to do high-tech jobs and stuff. We want to keep these intelligent people here. And, you know, that's a great idea. But that's not the only, that park is not the only game in town. Mm-hmm. That would always be their argument, and yeah. everyone would roll their eyes and go like, yes, but why does it have to be there? Why yeah. does it sure. have to be there?
So going back to, sorry for trailing off there,
no,
going
that's okay.
back to
yeah.
Austin, and
yeah.
when you were drinking with your buddies after yeah. bailing him out, what yeah. what happened after that?
Yeah, well, like I said, we decided to walk back to my apartment, and everyone just passed out. Everyone passed out in my bedroom. And it seems like it was about, it was probably about an hour or two later.
How old were you around this time? You said you were in college?
I wasn't. I was actually working for Advanced Micro Devices. Look at that, I was working for high tech. I was 25.
And what is that company, what did they do?
They're a big microchip company. They're competitors for IBM and anybody else. They make chips. They make the Ryzen chips right now that are pretty hot.
And what does that go on, like phones or computers?
CPUs and computers. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And how long were you there for?
You know, just long enough to look like a punk rocker and get fired. You know, no, I was there almost 3 years.
Oh, cool.
but anyway, you know, everyone passed out on the floor, and I woke about 2 hours later, and I heard this splattering sound, and it was right by my head. And I look, and the lead guitar player, there's a pee stream just coming right at me, man. It's like right next to my head. And I was like, oh, my God. And one of the other guys got up and, like, shoved the guy into yeah, the yeah. bathroom.
And
I'll never forget that. Like, hearing that sound, it was like, yeah. oh, my God. It was like 2 inches from my head.
These players that were in the band, were they, like, your friends? Or how mm-hmm. did you guys meet?
Yeah. God, you met people at that time just by walking the neighborhood, walking around, hanging out. There was a place on 24th Street called Mad Dog and Beans where people would just hang out drinking beer and people watch all day long. And right down the street from that was Les Amis, which was kind of an outdoor French place, outdoor and indoor. And people would just hang out there, eat, smoke cigarettes, drink beers, and people watch. And
nice.
It was just an open way to meet people. There's college students in all walks of life walking around at all times. And, you know, you just, the way to meet people then was just to hit the streets and walk around and meet people.
Cool.
And there were keg parties every weekend. And I mean, everyone kind of knew everybody around there. They didn't know anybody really well, but they knew them by sight. And it was like, so you didn't really have to have an invite to go to these parties. You know,
yeah.
people would kind of look at you like, yeah, yeah, come on, you know. And like you'd walk into the party and, you know, there was no such thing as party crashing unless you were, you know, with my group of people and you crashed a frat party. They didn't
yeah.
like you. You didn't crash frat parties. Those were half the time they were the enemy. They didn't like the punks too much.
So you consider yourself a punk?
Kind of, sort of. Yeah, I suppose I was.
Nice. So your time in Austin,
mm-hmm.
When did you first move over there? Around what age?
When I first got there?
To Austin.
I was almost 20 when I got there.
And before that, you were living here in the Valley?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was born and raised in McAllen. I was born in the old hospital downtown.
Nice. Can you talk to us a little bit about your childhood and you growing up? How was that like? Because you brought a movie Mm-hmm. Can you show us the movie?
Yeah, absolutely. Just the cover,
because it's an interesting movie about your family. That,
right, my father. Right.
Your father. Yeah, talk to us a little bit about the movie and about your childhood, like how I was growing up around your father.
Okay.
And, you know, just tell us a little bit more of you know, being in the factory and seeing all that in front of you. And
yeah. Sure. Well, the movie is Andy Paris, Bubblegum King. It's about my father, who was the Bubblegum King in the late 1940s. And he was the first person to mass produce bubblegum after World War II. Bubblegum, even since the time, and it was invented in 1922 by Walter Diemer, who worked for FLIR, okay? Bubblegum never really was made in gigantic batches. It was a victim of the 1930s depression, so it wasn't mm-hmm. made a whole lot then. By the time 1940s hit, they had actually started producing it, and then World War II hit, and there was heavy rationing of sugar and latex mm-hmm. being the key ingredient at the time.
What would they use it for? Oh, go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted.
What would they use? What?
The latex form.
Latex. It's a rubber. It's a natural rubber product.
But like it's they would rubber. Need it for the war.
For the war. Okay. Infantry boots, tires. You see, latex can be made in different forms. You have a very refined form, which is the kind that you use for like. Chewing gum or bubble gum, okay? And then you have the latex that goes into making tires, and then, you know, they put all kinds of chemicals and whatnot to make tires, infantry boots. So you couldn't get it. Mm-hmm. So once again, bubble gum suffers. It's never really a big thing. Mm-hmm. But my father had, he grew up in a family that worked the streets as a tobacconist since the time he was, four or five years old. They would sell things by the piece. They would sell peanuts. They'd sell apples. They sell cigarettes. And this family was a family of Greeks from Detroit, Michigan, okay? Mm-hmm. But my father, when he grew up living with that family in Greece, he spoke Greek in the household. Of course, he spoke English too. And because he was bilingual, he decided he wanted to learn Spanish. He learned Spanish. And when the war had broken out and he was still up there in Detroit, they didn't have any sweet stuff to sell because all the sugar was rationed. The family business was hurting. But he took a train and he went down to Mexico City, and he was able to find sweet stuff for his family to sell. And he brought it back home, kind of saved the family business. Eventually, you know, he struck out on his own, and he came down to the Rio Grande Valley. And because he spoke Spanish, after a while, he was doing very well at just being an import person. He imported candy and gum. He made a lot of friends with the Chicleras in Monterrey.
On the bridge?
Sure. And friends on the bridge, absolutely. He spoke great Spanish, and he could speak the Castilian Spanish that was required to speak to people in Mexico City. Yeah. Of course, down here in the valley, they were telling him, hey, you know, you got to change your Spanish a little bit, or they're gonna think you're, you know, kind of, I don't know what the word is in Spanish for being kind of stuck up or being kind of, you know, being
is that it?
Or being, you know, being aloof or whatever. And he's like, oh, no, I'll do what you say, or
Sangre.
And so he had to adopt it, the Tex-Mex style. You have to do that. You can't behave like that. And he caught on to that real quick. He had no problem with that.
So you literally had Willy Wonka as a father.
He had the Willy Wonka of bubblegum for a dad. But I mean, this all happened 15 years before I was born. Okay. I mean, this is all late 40s.
So you're born, and obviously you're not going to remember everything, but like, what was your first memory of seeing or I guess understanding that your father had built this type of business. What was your first reaction? Or
It took a long time. They didn't tell me about it for years. They didn't tell me about it because it was a very complex situation. What had gone down, what had happened, everything. You know, the first time I heard about it, I was nine. I was 9 years old, and my uncle came over to my house. I was watching, I think it was a Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier fight on closed circuit TV, and he mentioned something about, oh, that's back when your daddy was Bubblegum King. And I was like, Dad, what Bubblegum King? What's that, Dad? And he's like, no, son, I can't talk to you about it now, blah, blah, and just, you know, blew me off. He refused to talk about it. But when I was 12, I was down with the flu for a couple of days, and my mom went and rented a film projector, and then she went and she pulled out these huge scrapbooks that I'd never seen before, and then she told me, son, you know, your dad at one time was a very, very famous person, and she showed me film that actually eventually was got destroyed from the heat because it was nitrate film. You know about that, about how films like, but I got to watch it. It showed the opening day of his plant and how they had this gigantic a party in Reynosa afterwards, where literally the town of Reynosa ran out of ice because of this crazy party. So she showed me the scrapbooks. She showed me the front page news. I mean, it's amazing. He was front page news for 2 years in a row. I mean, front page news.
Where was that? Well, apart from selling bubblegum, what was interesting about his life that it was making front news?
It was making front page news because the kids hadn't had you have to picture this. You had 4 years of World War II. Kids hadn't had really anything. They had nothing. They had no tires for their bikes. They barely had shoes, okay? Shoes and anything that was made with rubber was rationed. There were ration books for shoes. I still have my mom's ration book for shoes, okay? There was ration books for sugar. The kids had no candy. The kids couldn't ride their, if the kids, you know, bike tires went flat, well, too bad. So they didn't have anything. But one day, you know, before all of this happened, you know, and my dad was working his regular job, which was that import business down on Main Street, 121 and a half Main Street, right over there by where the Phoenix Gallery is. Yeah. That's where it's just a small little Andrew J. Paris import sales. He's walking home, and you know where home was? Home was a cabana behind the Casa de Palmas. The Casa de Palmas used to have these little cabanas that they rent out to people, and that was home. So he was walking home. He crossed the street. He was probably by Archer Park. He saw these kids shoving each other, and it was like, you know, what's going on? What's going on? Well, we've been chewing this piece of bubblegum here and renting it, and this kid here chewed it, and he won't pay up. And my dad was like, what's the problem? He said, well, he owes us 35 cents. And he's like, 35 cents? He said, oh, yeah, we can't get this stuff. We can't get it at all. And we've been renting it between one another for the last 3 weeks. I was like, it's like rented. Some guy would chew it for a day for 35 cents. And then the next day, you know, another kid, and my dad thought, this is just crazy. This is totally
that's
nuts.
That's disgusting.
It is. And he was like, and he said, you guys like it that much? Oh, it's the greatest, but we can't get it.
Are you sure it was bubblegum?
And my dad was like, oh, okay. And the way he always tells me, he said, the wheels started turning. He said, because he knew a latex connection in Mexico City. So what he did was he said, I hightailed it to Mexico City and I met with these people. The guy he met with was Gabriel España. And my dad cornered the latex market for the entire Western Hemisphere for within 48 hours. He talked all the Chiclara plants down there. There was 13 of them. He said, let's make bubblegum and let's get rich making bubblegum. Wow. They converted to bubblegum. He dumped, you know, 5,000 tons on a market that was starving, that was crazy starving for bubblegum. And I mean, the kids just went nuts. You see these pictures of them, like, I mean, if you see my documentary, you can see where they're all reaching and screaming for it. He was like this. He was like I said, like you said, Willy Wonka, or like an Elvis, because he was like super good looking, really debonair, and going around making these kids happy that basically hadn't been happy for years. They didn't have a damn thing.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have anything. So that's big news. And Life magazine got wind of this, and they descended on the valley, and they started taking all these pictures of him. I've got all these incredible pictures that Cornell Kappa took of him on the bridge, in his building. There's even pictures of my mom when they weren't married. She was just his secretary, but there's all kinds of great pictures of her. And they published that... They dubbed him the Bubblegum King. They nice. Published that on February 3rd in 1947, and that had worldwide distribution. It was huge. It was huge. 3 weeks later, back then, the way that you went to the movies, I mean, I'm sorry, the way that you watched the news is you walked into a movie house, paid a dime, and you watched the newsreel.
Wow.
So 3 weeks after that, Universal... had shot a newsreel of it, and that was there, and that just pounded it even further in. And, you know, by that time, every radio show in the country wanted him on. He had to hire, a publicity person out in L.A., and he started doing the radio circuit. This is before television. That's another reason why the story was almost lost. This is before television. So he was on every big radio show of the day. It was crazy. My mom said that it was just insane how much attention he got and how they grabbed at his coattails and ran with him. This was the big story. This was, it's just wild.
What would they ask him in the radio, or what would he do, interviews, or what was he doing?
Yeah, so yeah, they would ask him, how much, are you making? How much are you making? My dad would say, I'm making $10,000 a day net profit.
Wow.
10,000 net. And I figured that out to be about $130,000 a day in today's money.
How
netting,
much?
Not gross.
How much?
130.
130,000?
Yeah. It's just the whole story. Wow. It's just crazy. I have all the evidence. All of it is presented in this documentary.
It's a documentary. Okay.
Yes, in this documentary, it's all presented.
Can you talk about where we can watch or where?
Yeah,
Who made the movie?
Yeah,
do you come out in it or what?
I am the executive producer and director. In the documentary, also a good friend of mine, Gabriel Ramirez, who teaches drama at PSJA Early College High School here. He's co-director and the main editor. Okay.
Oh wow.
And basically, the film has worldwide distribution. It's with through Gravitas Ventures. I mean, it's on Amazon Prime, it's on wow. iTunes, it's on Google Play, it's Vimeo On Demand. It's anywhere you want to look for it. You can buy DVDs, Blu-rays, or stream it on all those platforms.
If there's one thing you want people to take out of this documentary, what would that be?
I want them to know. If it was people from the valley, I'd want them to know that really important, incredible stuff happened many years ago that they wouldn't have ever dreamed of. I'd want them to know that I want people to know that being bilingual is money. it's a very important thing. What else?
No, but it is important because
it is
being able to communicate with two worlds, America and
sure.
Mexico. It's especially around that area,
mm-hmm.
around that time.
Mm-hmm.
back in the after World War II. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was important for both regions to come together
That's right. My dad was always a pro-Latino guy. My family's always been a pro-Latino guy. pro-Latino people. The working conditions were really good in the factory. It was air conditioned. You know, if you look at the historical marker, which, by the way, we got in 2013, it's there. It's at 609.
I saw you present it. You did a speech.
Yeah, right. And it was air conditioned, for 50 Hispanic women working there. Hispanic women working in an air conditioned plant. I mean, that's just incredible.
Especially back then.
My dad understood right away that being Mexicans friends and being friends with Latinos on this side was a very important thing. It's the way to be.
Right.
It's a way to have both cultures work together, and to be friends. I know he frowned upon any sort of mistreatment and stuff that had ever went on. I think there was some stuff right around 1980 and stuff that was going on in McAllen. My dad was not real happy about.
Mm. And can you tell us about your relationship with your father? Was there ever any type of you wanting to take over the factory or any type of thoughts like that?
Well, so we'll have to back up just a little bit, and then I can tell you the business, the bubblegum business, lasted for 8 years.
Eight. Wow.
That's it. It was a short reign for the king, okay? Because he was in an all cash business. It was in Mexico. It's no aceptamos cheques. Mm-hmm. He had a pistolero that would ride in the back of his Cadillac convertible when they haul ass down into Monterey, and he'd have sometimes $250,000 in a suitcase to pay his factory workers and to pay for the latex.
Wow.
Okay, all done in cash. So the IRS got wind of all this. They didn't like the fact that he was doing an all-cash business, and they decided to audit him, and they audited him into the ground. They disallowed a lot of his expenditures. And also before that happened, you had the competition coming back hard. You had the competition because there were a few years where a lot of that rationing was still going on, but my dad had the connection. Mm-hmm. He had sugar futures. He had sugar that he got from Mexico. He got all the latex from Mexico. And then he even had sugar futures here in the United States. William Wrigley from Wrigley's Chewing Gum actually had to call my father at one time and said, "Andy, you've got to free up some of those futures. I need to make my gum." He said, "Okay, wow. No problem." Wow. He didn't want to fight that guy. That guy's a giant. My dad's just a single businessman, who's probably, one of the wealthiest, young millionaires in the entire country.
Wow.
And that was the other thing that was a big stigma about it. All of that hit, just to back up a little bit. Once all of that hit, Hollywood called and wanted my father to be technical advisor in the bubblegum blowing scene for Miracle on 34th Street, which is a Christmas movie with Natalie Wood. And then that led him to dating Marilyn Monroe. Wow. And other starlets of the time. So he was just a superstar. Superstardom out of McAllen, Texas. I mean, he put the town on the map.
Nice.
He did. But as far as me, the business, like I said, lasted 8 years. And by 55, he was out of business. He was bankrupt. He was left with.
So there was no opportunity for you to take over whatsoever.
Right. But what he did is he got into the vending business. And so he was head on into the vending business when I was born in 61. McAllen was pretty small back then.
Mm-hmm.
I thought McAllen in the 60s and 70s was a really good looking town. This is before we had all where we had strip malls everywhere mm-hmm. that all were homogenized and looked the same. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're an appreciator of mid-century architecture, man, McAllen had it. It looked great.
Yeah, there's some houses too that are very mid-century.
Oh yeah.
And they look great.
They do. It's really sad. What I don't think I'll ever get over them tearing down the McAllen Civic Center. That was a mid-century marvel. That was an incredible.
Why did they tear it down?
I don't know, man. To make a parking lot. I know, it's just insane. I can't believe they did that, but they did. I feel really lucky that I was able to get my father's factory preserved. You know, now it's got the historical
laser
marker
tag.
On it.
Huh? It's a laser tag business, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
I've been there once. Have you ever been?
I haven't. I haven't. Actually, now it went from laser tag to a trapped escape room. Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It says trapped on there now. Right.
That's true. That's true. Right.
But the laser tag building was pretty cool looking too. I had been inside there because once we, but I never really looked at the laser tag stuff or anything like that. But, you know, my father worked really, you know, growing up in McAllen back then in my childhood, I'd say that it was quiet. I rode around on my bike everywhere, you know, and it's pretty friendly little town, but always somehow it always had kind of an upscale feel to it. It was the good looking town in the valley. It was the upscale good looking town in the valley.
I still think it is.
It is. It still is. That's
competing
correct.
With I think a couple other cities, but
yeah,
I think for the most part, McAllen is still number one. I feel in that regard.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about what you do, because you are also a music producer. Tell us a little bit about how you started. Was it because of that band? Is that where you started?
Oh, no. You know, I had a music interest really early. I mean, my mom, you know, my parents were older when I was born. So they were 40 and 43 years older than me. So they're like from a different generation. I heard a lot of classical and jazz in the house, you know, when I was growing up. And she played a lot of music for me all the time. She said I reacted to it really well, danced around the house and such. And, you know, started me out with piano lessons when like I was 9. When I was 12, I, you know, took a music aptitude test, which I aced a 200 perfect score. Nice. Me and my best friend did. We ended up being first chair players in band. I played trumpet, and then I went to the baritone. When I switched to braces, the trumpet mouthpiece wouldn't fit, so I went to a baritone or euphonium, which is a low brass instrument with valves. It's very warm, rich, and very melodic instrument. Nice. I think I was really lucky that I had that instrument. My parts were always great in band. That's the one thing that's good. A lot of times, a lot of instruments will have sort of secondary parts to the melody, and I always seem to have these melodic parts. So nice. That was good. I was in the jazz band in my junior year. Mm-hmm. But I had been listening to all kinds of contemporary music. I heard Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon for the first time. And you know, I sat there and I went, man, this is what I gotta be doing. I gotta be doing something spacey and mysterious and really just, you know, otherworldly. This is where I want to be in music. Because I heard that just blew my mind. You know, I heard that when I was like 15, and I was just like, okay, I think I know what I want to do. And then not long after that, one of my friends who played drums in the band, he was a year ahead of me, he started a garage band. Mm-hmm. And he was practicing, and I was like, oh my God, these guys are playing guitars and drums, and we don't have a bass player. You should learn how to play bass sometime. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And actually, they talked me into it, but by then, they weren't together anymore. Mm-hmm. I actually found a bass player for them. He was a friend of mine. But that's when I got the bug. It was like, okay, I think I want to be a bass player. And nice. It kind of translated well from the euphonium, the low brass instrument, to playing bass. From then on, I just, I was in, you know, a couple of bands here in McAllen, Roulette and Mask. And we were writing our own tunes. We didn't do cover tunes. I was never into doing cover tunes. Just not my thing. Although I learned how to play bass by learning some of those because, mm-hmm. you know, learning other people's parts, it's part of the learning process. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with doing that. But I also believed that I should spend my time trying to find my own voice in this world. And you're not going to find your own voice in this world if you're just constantly playing somebody else's stuff. I think when you're starting out, it's very helpful to roadmap things and to get a feel for things. But, you know, if I was ever giving anybody any really sage advice, which I think I'm probably doing now, is that you got to find your own voice in this world. You really do. So McAllen in the Valley at that time was very small. Mm-hmm. I played a gig at a place called the Valley Balloon Company. It was a place that served beer and launched balloons mm-hmm. off of North 10th Street. And it was a really fun gig. It was my first gig, but there weren't any places to play around here. I think there was a gig over at the Citrus. The Steroids were friends of ours. They were like the first punk band down yeah. here. In fact, they're featured in As I Walk Through the Valley. They're very good friends of mine. Oh, really? That's how I met Charlie Vela and Ronnie Garza because I got in touch with them because I told them I knew the Steroids. Nice. And they ended up doing their interview at my house. But back to McAllen at that time, it's that we had to flee mm-hmm. and leave and go to Austin and find some places to play.
Why is that?
There's no places to play. There really wasn't enough place to play down here. Well, I mean, it was dead. Yeah, yeah. It's not like now there's places everywhere. There was just nothing.
Yeah. Well,
there was nothing for us.
Going forward a little bit, you sent me a trailer of a, mm-hmm. I think it was like a buddy zombie movie.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you said that you had been the composer.
I was actually associate producer on the zombie that was Pete and Repeat, right? Because I had some edit ideas on that, I actually did some audio cleanup on that.
Oh, cool! Mm-hmm. How did you get started, or how did you first get involved with making movies and productions like that?
With the documentary on my father, that started everything off. I was basically slated with just being the composer. For that film, but it grew into having to do other things because some people couldn't entirely do what they needed to do in the film. You know, some people had to be let go on that production.
So you were wearing many hats.
I wore lots of hats. I mean, I became the dialogue editor for Andy Paris, Bubblegum King, where you have to meticulously go through all the dialogue and cut out and forensically cut out any noises, any taps and clicks, any dialogue, and get it as perfect as you can. And then I, you know, scored everything. I wrote entire pieces that I was able to plug in to the film. And then I actually did some actual scoring and very light music beds as well. And that's how I got into doing it, because by being forced to have to do it. Okay.
Wow. What year was this made?
It was released in 2017.
Oh, so it's recently new.
It started in 2005.
Wow.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Why did it take so long?
12 years.
Why was it so long?
It took 12 years. Wow, is right. So, that was wild.
Can you tell us one more time where can people watch this documentary? Because it sounds really like a lot of work, and thank you again for bringing a copy. I'm definitely going to try to find my PlayStation mm-hmm. and play it there. But where could people watch it?
Yeah, it streams on Amazon Prime. I believe that it's on Tubi. I believe that it's also, I know it's on Vimeo On Demand. It's on iTunes. You can rent or purchase the download there.
Okay.
and Microsoft Xbox. It's on there too. I mean, it's a worldwide distribution. Also, if you want to be old school and you want to buy, a DVD or a Blu-ray, like, you know, this is it, you know, to have a keepsake. The one thing that's nice about these is that there's outtakes on here. So you've got like maybe about four little outtakes. This is a cool like little movie we shot of these two little kids playing accordions in Nuevo Progreso and singing. This is super cool.
Nice.
And then there's like some shots of my old house in there. But I think back to music. I am a music producer, and music is probably my main thing.
Where can people reach you?
Oh, my music is Paris Music Corporation, or Paris Music Corp, C-O-R-P dot.
Nice.
Okay? It's a mix of kind of dark wave, ambient, I would call it post-rock.
So anybody that has a short film or a documentary going on, they could reach out to you, right?
Or absolutely. Who ParisMusicCorp.com.
Who are you trying to help?
I would think that it's very suitable. It's very for cinema. Okay,
love that,
and for listening too. Nice. It's instrumental music, and it's out on all platforms. I mean, it's out on Spotify. It's out on Amazon. It's out on Apple. It's everywhere. I can't even name all the platforms that it's on. It's a gazillion of them, you know.
So if people want to connect with you, where could they find you? Are you on Instagram, Facebook?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram, you know, John Paris on Facebook, Paris Music Corp on Instagram.
Love that.
And that's how you'd be able to reach me there.
I wanted to ask you this question because I ask it to all my guests, and it's always interesting to see the different answers.
Mm-hmm.
There's this saying here in the Valley. Mm-hmm. It's Puro 956.
Yeah.
What have you heard of it? And if you have, what does that mean to you?
I have heard of it. I saw where you had asked somebody that, and I was like, oh my God, when it's my turn, what am I going to say here? Because I mean, it could mean anything.
But for you, what does it mean for you? Or what's your take on it?
Well, you know, when I think about that, I think about how you can cruise out in the middle of nowhere and be the tallest thing around.
So the actual street races.
No.
What do you mean?
There are places in the Valley where you can drive still, and it's wide open, and there's no houses, like Military Highway. Oh. There's a place on Military Highway where it looks like you can see for miles. It's just super flat, and you are the tallest thing around.
Wow.
That's a Puro 956, because I kind of missed that. You know, up in Austin, it's the hill country, it's pretty and everything, but you know what? Down here, you can see the sun all the way down until it's down. You know, when you have the hills and stuff, you know, you have these sunsets and whatever, and they're pretty, but they're obscured by hills and crap here. You can see it. Puro 956 to me means like you can be the tallest thing, and you can find yourself being the tallest thing in the Valley in the middle of nowhere.
That's a good one. I've never heard of that one. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Maybe it's all the smoking out there in the middle of nowhere. I don't know. You know,
I've never had someone reference I've never heard a compliment about how flat the RGV is. So that's the first time I hear someone actually say something positive about the flatness of.
It is positive. You can see more of the. You can see more of the sunset. You can see every little inch of it going down, and it's there. There's a grandiose feeling of you seeing this and being the tallest thing around. You feel like a giant. Puro 956 is. You feel like a giant in the valley when it's flat like
that. Land of the giants.
Yeah.
So I know that you have to drive back to Brownsville. So for my last question, I want to ask you, is there anything that you want to share with the world, anybody that's listening, anything that you have on your chest, anything that's on your mind that you want to let the world know?
Anything that's on my chest, anything that I want to let the world know. Gosh, it's okay. It's okay to be an escapist in your art, okay? Because you're never going to really be able to fix all the problems that are out there. Embrace your art and make it yours. You know, find your own voice, find your own vision. You know, don't worry so much about what somebody else has done. You know, be you.
Love that. Thank you so much for coming to Backdoor Modern Vintage here with Yvette and sharing your story. And I'm definitely going to, you know, try to find that PlayStation and watch it. And so should a lot of people because, like you said, he really put McAllen on the map.
Right. He really did put McAllen on the map. And, you know, I don't want to, when I say that to people, you know, the one thing that I want to say about that is that it's a hard thing to say without sounding like some sort of braggart, right? Like, oh, I'm bragging about my dad. Yeah, he put McAllen. These are facts. McAllen was known as a farming community. And, you know, and a citrus community. Citrus was king, everything. There was really nothing going on down here. That's okay, and that's okay. But my dad descended down here. He did this crazy big thing, and I mean, it was just explosive.
Yeah,
it was incredible.
A lot of commerce.
A lot of commerce. You know, my dad was used as a secret weapon when there were disputes between Reynosa and McAllen. They'd get him. Yes. I remember calls in the middle of the night to get people, the important people out of jail. Wow. Guess who they called? They called Andy.
The bubblegum king.
They called him to go get, help get somebody out of jail in Reynosa because somebody mouthed off or something. They got in trouble. Call up Andy Paris. He knows everybody. He knew everyone on that bridge. And, you know, there was money made. What is it called? Is it the payoff money, the mordida or whatever?
Yeah, that's tax collector.
Huh?
The tax collector.
That's right.
But thank you so much again.
Sure.
I appreciate you coming.
Yeah.
And congratulations on making that movie. And for your
Thank
continued
you.
Success in music
that.
Production and spreading the word on the Valley. Thank you.
Absolutely. I love the Valley.